You're listening to an On the Move Media Co. production.
Yeah, absolutely. So I really just help people who are not technical people figure out what to do and how to make sense of this new technology, which really has just come to everybody, including people who are computer programmers, with a big surprise and a big force, and faster than any of us, frankly, can keep up with it. And so, you know, I try and like clear out a lot of the clutter and make something that feels very overwhelming to people approachable and simple. And like anything, if you just try it and you can kind of get through that first hurdle, I mean, you know, we work out, like if you can just get to the gym, doing the workout at the gym is a lot easier than like just sitting on your couch. So I think, you know, I basically try and train, and like maybe a personal trainer is a good example. I'm like a personal trainer for AI.
That was Lori Mazur. This is Marnie Salop. Thanks for tuning into my podcast, Marnie on the Move. Each week, I will be inviting interesting, innovative movers and shakers to join me on the show and share their story. You will discover and hear from thought leaders, experts, influencers, and entrepreneurs from the worlds of wellness, sports, beauty, fitness, fashion, and more. Marnie on the Move will feature an eclectic mix of people I know, work with, and think are generally doing cool things. On each episode, I sync up with my guests about life, career, and training, and showcase their expertise and story. Hello, welcome, and welcome back to the Marnie on the Move podcast. I'm your host, Marnie Salop. I'm super psyched to share today's convo and guest, Lori Mazur, CEO and founder of Synthetivity and author of top-selling new book, Temperature, Creativity in the Age of AI. Full disclosure, Lori is my partner in life and all things. She is also a triathlete, runner, and multi-talented creator across many realms of art, entertainment, and business. I am beyond proud of her as she just launched her first book, and it is amazing. Lori is a leading voice in generative AI executive education. Her expertise in technology and innovation makes her a sought-after speaker and thought leader. Trained as an architect with a 25-year career in higher education operations, Lori made a career transition in 2022 with a mission to teach AI with a human touch at the intersection of AI and creativity. Synthetivity is her venture dedicated to enlightening leaders about generative AI's transformative power, revolutionizing paradigms in executive education. With her interdisciplinary background and forward-thinking approach, Lori has equipped thousands with generative AI know-how. Internationally recognized for embedding generative AI into education, workforce development, and business, Lori is changing the AI landscape. Her expertise is valued at institutions like NYU, Fordham, and Ed3Down, where she has taught, crafted novel curricula, and pioneered the first high school generative AI course. Prior to teaching, Lori led the planning, design, and operations at prestigious academic institutions like NYU and CUNY. Her credentials include a Yale Master's of Architecture, NYU MBA, Wellesley BA, and Wharton certification in the business economy of the metaverse. She is an acclaimed artist. Her work has been showcased in the New York Times, Inside Higher Ed, Cranes, and the Wall Street Journal, and she has been named among the top 100 AI artists and top voices in creativity and innovation. Get ready for an eye-opening, fascinating conversation with Lori all about her new book, Temperature, Creativity in the Age of AI, and where it all began. All right, let's go. Lori, it is so amazing to have you on the podcast today. You were one of my first guests on the podcast. I'm really grateful to have you here to talk about what's new, what's exciting, and everything that is happening in the world of Lori Mazur. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Hi, Marnie. Nice to see you again.
Yeah. I really enjoyed reading your new book, Temperature, Creativity in the Age of AI. What was the inspiration behind this book?
So I think probably when we first met, I said I was writing a book. That was like 11 years ago. I was in business school at the time, and I was also managing creative teams at New York University. I was in charge of design and construction and planning. And so we hired architects, and we would give them a brief, you know, what we wanted the project to be. And some teams were extremely creative, but their projects would come in over budget and over schedule. And other teams really stuck to the budget and the schedule, but there was just something that was less inspiring. And so I was really just at the time trying to figure out practically how to get the most out of creative people. And I knew that both teams had creativity. I just felt like I wasn't writing the rules right. So when I was in business school, I decided I was really interested in game theory. And I took a class with Adam Brandenberger, and I decided that I would do a thesis. And my thesis was to study the systems that influence creativity, basically the way that we structure rules and how different people, different personality types, different cognitive styles engage with different rule systems.
So, and what is your definition of creativity? Because you talk about creativity.
Yeah, so I feel like a lot of people, when they talk about creativity, what they really mean are you coming up with novel ideas? Is what you're doing different from what other people are doing? Are you breaking out of the noise? But what I've found is that creativity is really a process. And it's not just about coming up with an idea. It's also about inventing things as you go along and make incremental small decisions. I love to cook, as you know, and I spend a lot of time in the kitchen. And I've been working for many years on my no tomato sauce, right? I love the idea of like taking constraints and using them to inspire what I do in the kitchen. And so I couldn't make tomato sauce because we had allergies. Couldn't make tomato sauce with tomatoes. And so I kind of figured out what can I substitute in order to make a sauce that tastes and has the same flavor as tomatoes. And a lot of creativity is like that, right? You might have a constraint, or you might just like maybe be missing an ingredient that day and have to make a substitution. So I call this everyday creativity. And what I really started to figure out is that nothing comes from out of the blue. Everything comes from the world around us. And when I wanted to find a name for my company, I didn't quite know exactly what I wanted to do at the time, but I knew it wanted to be about this philosophy I had about creativity. And I found a word. The word is a tongue twister, and everybody like trips over it when they say it. And I've been advised it's a terrible word for a business, but I kind of like it for that reason.
Of course.
And the word is synthetivity. Instead of creativity, which is the idea that you might make something out of nothing, you are synthesizing, and you are synthesizing from the world around us. And it came from scientists, genomicists, who were studying the human genome and understanding how the human has evolved over time. And, you know, my experience in being both in educational settings, learning about creativity as a, you know, art historian and an architect, and then actually practicing it, is that, yes, it is a synthetic process, and it happens across a full spectrum, from tightly structured systems of recipes to open-ended chances that we take.
And you talk about in your book, like right brain, left brain creativity, and where that kind of idea started. And I really liked the scientific facts and background around that. So can you talk about that a little bit on the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that sometimes what we find is that the things that we've come to believe are true, a lot of times through like memes that we see on social media, right? Or like posts that pseudoscientists put up, is that we have two sides to our brain, right? Everybody has seen this. Like, we've kind of come to understand ourselves as either being right-brained or left-brained, right? If you are right-brained, then you might be more able to think in three dimensions. And if you are left brain, then you might be better at math or better at languages. And there were actually scientific studies that were done starting in the 1950s and moving forward to the 1980s that showed that, yes, there are specific parts of your brain that do perform certain functions. But, you know, kind of like a game of telephone, as that science got translated into popular culture, people interpreted it in their own way. And it came to represent an idea that art is on one side of the brain and math and science are on the other side of the brain, which is just absolutely not true. So, you know, as I was like growing up as a kid, I actually learned how to code when I was in fourth grade. And by the time I got to high school, I was really challenged in science. But rather than my teacher trying to figure out how to adapt the curriculum to my learning style, he just told me to stick with dancing. So, you know, I think a lot of people of our generation kind of got pigeonholed in that way. And I would say, you know, it was probably more women who got pigeonholed into those softer skill things and more men who got put into the you're not creative, you're an analyst role. Right. But we know that, you know, that is not gender based. And actually more recent neuroscience and cognitive science studies show that our brains operate holistically in everything. And they looked at a whole series of studies that had been done and actually looked at studies where they mapped the brain, right, through different kinds of imaging, and found that your whole brain lights up when you're being creative. And you can't really pinpoint creativity to being just novel ideas, right? It's a process. Right.
So who is this book for? Who should buy this book? Who should be reading this book? Talk to me about your audience. Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote this book really thinking of three different kinds of people and use cases. First is I wanted to write to somebody who would like go to the bookstore looking for inspiration. I mean, in many ways, I kind of wrote it for me. I used to love just like walking into a bookstore and browsing, you know, sometimes like the popular psychology section or maybe the business section, but just kind of like looking for something that would help me to learn something that I never learned before. And honestly, some of my favorite authors are Gretchen Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell and so many others, but I'll just like leave it at those two. So, you know, I wanted to make it for people who would go to find those books. I would love it if it were also on the bestseller list. We'll talk about that later. But it's really to kind of figure out how you can become more creative, more holistically creative, no matter where your, what I call your creative sweet spot starts. And the second audience is really, you know, thinking about my role at NYU and needing to manage teams and how to figure out how to adjust to different cognitive styles so that everybody in your team can contribute to all parts of the innovation process. And so I have guidelines and, you know, somebody who's in a managerial position can kind of understand 25 different personas and how they operate and, you know, look at the ones that are going to be most conducive to how your team's going to function well, given the task at hand. So my third audience is, I wrote this book in the age of AI, and a lot of the things that I wrote about 10 years ago, now I really started to understand as I became an AI artist and I started working and teaching AI and learning how to communicate effectively with machines and really understanding how machines create. And the title of the book, Temperature, is because the metric for how machines create is called temperature. It's a dial. You can dial it from 0 to 1. If it's down at 0, it's going to give you the most popular, the most precise, the most frequent responses. And if it's dialed all the way up to 1, it's going to give you the most random, the most chaotic responses. And so for those people who really want to get deep to that technical side, I've written a technical book for non-technical people. So if you're AI curious, this book is for you. It's approachable. You'll read it like a story. I'll explain it in analogies, and I'll try and demystify some of those that technical speak so it feels approachable.
Awesome. And so for people to figure out their persona, there's a quiz, which I think everybody loves to figure out, like where they are on this temperature spectrum and what their creativity persona is. So talk to me about the quiz, the 5 attributes, and the personas, and how readers can use this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the most fun parts of the book for me. I've always felt like books are interactive, that it's an equal part participant who's reading the book. You read between the lines, literally. And so the quiz is a way of making it even more interactive. So halfway through the book, there's a quiz. If you hate quizzes, then you don't have to take it. And you know what? You're probably on the high temperature end of the spectrum. But if you love a quiz and if you love analysis and or if you frankly just want to have a good time, I encourage people to take it. It's online and you'll take about 20 questions. They're scenario based. So they'll put you in different scenarios where you're forced to make a decision about how you are going to respond to a set of rules. And then I'll give you back your dominant persona. It's one of five personas. It's the place where your cognitive style aligns with that rule system. And then there are 25 total personas. So we go through the middle part of the book, goes through each chapter, recipes, improvisations, negotiations, prohibitions, and chances. And in each part of the book, there is specific guidance for you and what personas your archetype would adopt best if you are faced with a rule system that maybe you might feel uncomfortable in.
Shout out to our partners at HVMN and Ketone IQ. Ketone IQ is fuel for your brain. These exogenous ketones give you a clean energy boost without sugar or caffeine. I'm a big fan of exogenous ketones for training, racing, and everyday health. They increase your energy, your focus, and metabolic flexibility. They're also the brain's preferred fuel source over glucose. I've been using HVMN's Ketone IQ individual shots on training runs and in races. I take one 30 minutes before a run or ride. I feel it 20 minutes into my session, and then I drink a second bottle after an hour, and so on. One of my favorite things about Ketone IQ is that it's drinkable, which is key when it comes to exogenous ketones. They are truly an asset to whatever nutrition plan you're following. You don't have to give up your carbs. They work independently. Imagine you're in a traffic jam. Suddenly, a new lane opens up. This is the exogenous ketones lane. HVMN and Ketone IQ work with top Olympic athletes like Des Linden and Michael Andrews, Ironman world champion Sam Laidlow, and top world tour cycling team, Team Visma Lisa Bike. It's time to level up your athletic performance and everyday health by adding HVMN's Ketone IQ to your workouts and daily routine. Visit hvmn.com/Marnie for 30% off your first subscription order. Now back to our conversation.
And now do you have like a like something in the book where it's like, if you're this persona, you'd work well with this persona, or, you know, like anything like that?
That's good. You know, I don't, but maybe this might be book
part two.
But also, yeah, this might be part two, but also, I am building for when the book is released, and this will probably come out like in a couple of weeks, what we call a GPT. This is for somebody who has ChatGPT. You need to have a plus or above account. But basically, the whole book will be uploaded to the knowledge base, and you can ask those kinds of questions.
Okay.
And cool. You will get a response that's based on the, like, you know, the writing of my book. With a little AI riffing on that. So yeah,
awesome.
Pose a question and ask it to GPT.
All right, awesome. Well, what's your persona?
Oh yeah. So I think my dominant persona is what I've called entertainer. And it basically is somebody who operates well in an improvisational rule system. So I don't like a lot of structure. If I have too much structure, I kind of rebel against it. And I don't like a blank page either. Like if I walk into a cereal aisle and I don't have a mission, like of something that I'm going to get, I get overwhelmed by choices. So for me, a little bit of structure gives me enough grounding to feel like I can riff off of it. And so that's where I feel most comfortable, in the traditional sense of like how we use the word improvisation. Like I'm also good on my feet, right? So
yes.
Like if things switch up at the last moment, or, you know, plans don't go as intended, like, I don't like fret about it. I'm like pretty good at, you know, figuring things out. And I think that's because I do enjoy the challenge, right? But I don't enjoy it when like the whole world falls apart,
right?
from underneath me, and I don't have not so great with just like in, you know, everything being ambiguous.
And what do you think my persona is?
Oh yeah. I mean, I definitely put you in the prohibition category. So prohibitions are interesting.
Oh great.
You know, the most famous one was obviously the big prohibition in 1920 when the United States banned the sale of alcohol for 13 years. And what you saw, and actually there's like an entire chapter on this, but it's actually quite fascinating. what different people did in order to figure out how to work around that rule, right? Some people like followed it very strictly, but were super inventive. In fact, like the owners of Beringer Wine, it was a woman, and she came up with the idea of these things called raisin bricks. And raisin bricks basically were just like dried raisins that were like compacted into a brick, and you could buy them and they fermented. And so you basically could just like drop these things in water and it would turn into wine.
Wow.
And this was totally legal, right? She didn't break any rules, totally legal. But there was like a cheeky little like prohibition on the package of bricks that said, like, whatever you do, don't drink this in water. Knowing full well that's what people would do.
Well, and in addition to this book, you've been speaking, leading workshops, boot camps around the globe, and including an amazing TEDx talk. You've been teaching engineering students in India virtually, and you also did a workshop for the United Nations and Ukrainian evacuees living in Poland. You've taught over 5,000 people on how to leverage the power of AI, from personal use to corporate use and marketing. How can people bring you into their organization or sign up for one of your boot camps or workshops?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really just help people who are not technical people figure out what to do and how to make sense of this new technology, which really has just come to everybody, including people who are computer programmers, with a big surprise and a big force, and faster than any of us, frankly, can keep up with it. And so, you know, I try and like clear out a lot of the clutter and make something that feels very overwhelming to people, approachable and simple. And like anything, if you just try it and you can kind of get through that first hurdle, I mean, you know, we work out, like if you can just get to the gym, doing the workout at the gym is a lot easier than like just sitting on your couch. So I think, you know, I basically try and train, and like maybe a personal trainer is a good example. I'm like a personal trainer for AI, and I teach a lot of CEOs, vice presidents, like senior level people, many of whom are over 50 and some of whom are career transitioning. And I do it in a small, intimate boot camp setting where people can learn both from me and from each other. That is probably one of the most rewarding experiences that I have. I like teaching in small groups, and I like teaching in a bespoke way, because many busy people, especially senior level people, don't have the time to go on YouTube and like watch a video. They need something that's delivered to them and in their learning style. But I also then go into corporations and teach, you know, large groups of people those same skills. And then I get to do some of my mission-driven work, which is really to help women, and particularly women around the globe who might have been displaced because of war or may not have access to the same kinds of services that we have here, give them the tools and the experience so that they can begin to use this in their career development.
Awesome. So when you say you're teaching AI, like, are you teaching certain kinds of programs, platforms, apps? Yep. Like, which ones are your favorite right now?
Absolutely. I mean, I have been solidly teaching Midjourney, which is an image generator, and ChatGPT since the very beginning. So this is about a year. I also do a lot of experimentation myself with lots of other tools, but I try and keep it simple for people. Really, the two foundational technologies are image generation and large language models. And you can find both of those in ChatGPT. For $20 a month, you can get a subscription. For $25 a month, you can get a subscription and privacy. And so from my perspective, it's worth it for somebody to invest for a month. And then from there, they can better figure out what tools that are out there, maybe something that's like more aligned with their particular use case. So for example, architects, if you are doing architecture, you might use a product called LookX, or you might use something called Crea, which gives you both AI, but also the ability to kind of work with some of the traditional models and drawing techniques that you're already using. So yeah, start in a one place, learn the skills, and then they're transferable.
Awesome. And so you mentioned ChatGPT, which by now is like the same thing as Google, essentially. I mean, it's not the same thing as Google, but everybody knows it. Like, anybody who doesn't know about ChatGPT is living under a rock, I would say, at this stage of the game. So, you know, and I think, you know, for me, and I know my listeners are like all, you know, all different kinds of careers, from lawyers to professional athletes to entrepreneurs to executives. And I feel like ChatGPT is like the easiest way to get into the world of AI these days. And it's been incredibly useful for me to help with show notes or questions or research, and also like taking my show notes and turning it into an Instagram post or turning it into a LinkedIn post. And all of that was thanks to you forcing me for my listeners to use it. I refused in the beginning. I was like, it will take me more time to put this in ChatGPT than it will take me to actually write. But so what do you say to the naysayers, and like, how can people like me really benefit from this beyond what I just said?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, you've got your naysayers who use it. They will probably use the free version. They will type in a question or ask it to do something. They will get a response. They will say, I'm smarter than that. And they'll like put it aside.
Yeah.
But the truth is that, like, number one, version 3.5 of the model versus 4, which is the difference between the free version and the paid version, is like light years difference, right? It's like driving an old car versus like picking one up off the lot. So like, you spend a lot of money on a lot of different things, give up something for $20 a month and invest in ChatGPT. It will save so much time and energy. It's absolutely worth it. I think the other naysayers, there is something worthy in the naysaying, and it is good to be cautious. So ethics are a big deal. There are lots of issues with these models. There's issues with how they've come into being. There's issues with bias. There's issues in terms of how they can be used to create deep fakes. So it's riddled with challenges. And, you know, with that, I say, bring that to the table, right? We need all voices here to be able to make these systems work for us as humans, as opposed to us being slaves to them. And so I think it's really important, particularly for people, women, people of color, the BIPOC community, just bring your whole self and use it, because we are training the model. And if we don't use it, we don't get to have a say. This is not going away. So I think it's really about figuring out how to use it for good.
That's awesome. And now, you know, during this past year of you building and writing your book and working in AI and doing your career pivot, you took a year off of triathlon training. So are you coming back? Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I think a couple of things happened. I think, you know, I got COVID, and after COVID, I had easy recovery, but then I had all kinds of issues with plantar fasciitis, like worse than I've ever had it before. So that made me stop running. And then, you know, once I stopped running, it was like hard to get back into everything. And at the same time, I realized that I have, you know, I was training like between 10 and 16 hours a week, depending on what time of year, right? And now I write for 10 to 16 hours a week. So, you know, I couldn't do both. And I think it's important for people to realize, like, there's no such thing as balance. You got to pick, and you can't have everything all the time. So I had to give up my body in order to focus on my mind. And I just transferred all those skills that I learned in triathlon in terms of like endurance to how can I be now an endurance writer, right? I had written a lot of short form content. I'd never written a book. And so how do I stick with it long enough to like get to the end of this and get the medal, right? I got the medal. But it was also like a 9-month pregnancy, and with that pregnancy of the book came like my baby weight. So I think I've got to figure out now how to get back to the gym to lose the book baby weight.
Yeah, I mean, and as a triathlete, are there any like big lessons that you took from your years of doing triathlon into the book, in addition to your endurance training, into writing this book, into your career pivot, into everything that you do in your career?
Yeah, I would say train slow to go fast has been the biggest lesson that I've learned from triathlon. I remember that, you know, when I first started running, I really wanted to always be running under a 10-minute mile. And, you know, even that seemed slow at the time. But I, you know, I would really push myself that every run I would go out and I would at least like hit those numbers. And when I started going longer and longer distances, I realized that I couldn't hit those numbers anymore. And I really needed to slow down so that I could do that like long endurance, long run training. And that was like a big eye opener. And the same thing with the book. In that period of 10 years when I was not writing, I was collecting stories. I was doing slow training. I was keeping a journal. I was like really doing all of the things I needed to prepare to write. So when it finally came time for me to write this book, I wrote it in 9 weeks. And the chapter structure that I put down on the page the first time I wrote the table of contents is the exact same table of contents that I have now. Now, I did go back later and spend about 3 months like really perfecting my writing, working with a copy editor, like, you know, really putting all the polish on it. But, you know, I really attribute that fast writing process to the slow work that I did to get there. So I hope I have more than one book every 10 years in me, but I definitely am going to return back to collecting some stories and just kind of like living for a while and waiting to see what inspires me next.
Awesome. Well, this has been super great. Thank you for being a guest on the podcast. And for all my listeners, let them know where they can find you on LinkedIn, where they can, mm-hmm. on your website, synthetivity.net. Go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me. I'm Lori Mazur. I teach AI with a human touch on LinkedIn. You can find me at synthetivity.net for my website, where you can find